Today's episode of the Film Stage Show is brought to you by Mubi, the streaming online cinema. For your free 30-day trial of Mubi, go to mubi.com/filmstage.
Gossip, gossip, nigga, just stop it. Everybody knows I'm a motherfucking monster. I'ma need to see your fucking hands at the concert. I'ma need to see your fucking hands at the concert. Profit, profit, nigga, I get it. Everybody know I'm a motherfucking monster. I'ma need to see your fucking hands at the concert. I'ma need to see your fucking hands.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to a brand new episode of the Film Stage Show, the movie review podcast of thefilmstage.com. I'm your host, Brian J. Rowan. With me today to talk about the film Colossal, starring Anne Hathaway, we have Bill Graham.
Yeah!
And Michael Snydell.
Good morning.
Good morning. We are back after releasing two episodes on Friday. Odds are this one will come out mid to late Sunday slash early Monday, so apologize for taking over your podcast feed. But changes in the guard have required that I do this now, and it took me a little while to get into the swing of things, but now that I have, I'm going to try to push these things out much sooner after we record than was usually the norm. So, see how it goes. Speaking of taking over your podcast feed, the plan is that later in this week, we will also release a review of Free Fire, the newest film by Ben Wheatley. So, get used to hearing us for a while.
Lucky you.
Yeah. So that's some housekeeping. Some more housekeeping. Follow us on Twitter at Film Stage Show. Follow us on Facebook, search for The Film Stage Show, and of course email us, podcast@thefilmstage.com. And should you ever spare a moment to think of us, perhaps you could go on iTunes and give us a comment and a rating. I'm not going to be as passive-aggressive as usual. Oh, man. All right. Before we get into the movie plug, guys, anything new, anything fun going on that you want to talk about?
Your Name, I want to mention that real quick.
Have you seen it?
I haven't seen it yet, but it's
what?
On. It's, I just wanted to mention it.
All right. Firm mention without recommendation of Your Name. That we may have talked about it previously. That's the one that like broke every record in Japan. It's an animated film. We are trying to do something on it. It just depends on where it's playing and who can see it, and if we can get a guest to fill in if someone can't see it. It's a weirdly crowded time of year for good movies.
Yeah.
April is the new November, I guess. So
yeah, we're also trying to see Lost City of Z, trying to put that together as well. So
yeah, that's going to be our definite pick for next weekend is Lost City of Z. And then Your Name could become the Free Fire of the week that follows. I don't know.
Sure.
Well, and then A Quiet Passion at some point, potentially.
Potentially A Quiet Passion. Not sure. Not even sure if it's playing near me. This goes
a lot
back
of good,
to our...
There's
our
a, lot
long...
of, a lot of good movies coming out here.
Yes. But again, we're stuck in the middle of that same problem we had last Oscar season, where it's like, why does no one know when these things are coming out and where they're coming out? I don't know why that is. I don't know if it's because most studios are just giving them token releases expecting to get picked up on VOD, or if they just don't care about us.
Well, it could be
New York and LA cities. It's strange.
Well, I think part of it, and not to go off on to a tangent, but I think part of it may be that some of these are true platform releases where the studios are basically like, let's just see how it does. And if it picks up steam, it picks up steam. And sometimes it doesn't. Sometimes it does.
But it's weird because a platform release used to be like New York and L.A. this weekend, everywhere next weekend. And now it's like New York and L.A. the 14th, where you live, I don't know. We'll see.
Yep.
It feels like film distribution, even in a theatrical sense, has become much more on demand. We won't give it to you unless these test markets like it. Just like McDonald's Mighty Wings. Anyway.
Sure.
That's
a metaphor. I don't know what that is.
You don't know what Mighty Wings are?
No, but if you had mentioned the Szechuan sauce from Mulan, I would have laughed really hard. But you didn't. You didn't go there. Yes.
All right. Anyway, before we get into our review, let's talk about Mubi. Mubi is the streaming online cinema where their curators find some of the best films that you may have never heard of for you to watch. And we are being sponsored by them, so you can get a free 30-day trial of Mubi by going to mubi.com/filmstage. One of the movies on Mubi that may interest people, because I know he's the internet's boyfriend, this movie stars Tom Hiddleston, and that is Joanna Hogg's Archipelago. This is a 2010 film, and this is the synopsis. A family vacation pushes and prods the limits of relationships and the spaces that define and confine them. So, if you ever wanted to see British people in a tense situation, and if you love Tom Hiddleston, this is like pre-breakout or like mid-breakout Tom Hiddleston, check out Archipelago. That is on Mubi. You still have 22 days to watch that, so if you sign up now, you'll have plenty of time with it. And remember that
everybody
every day
has this really serious scarf in the picture I'm looking at right now.
Everybody loves a British person in a serious scarf. Yes, so every day Mubi releases a new film, and you have 30 days to watch, so you'll get a constantly rotating cavalcade of films. So go to mubi.com/filmstage, and you get a free 30-day trial on us. All right, so that is that. Gentlemen, I believe now is the time for us to get into our feature review. Again, that is Colossal, the newest film from writer-director Nacho Vigalondo. And this movie stars Anne Hathaway and Jason Sudeikis. And here is the trailer.
You don't remember anything last night, huh?
I got really melodramatic, didn't I?
You told me that you weren't really on a vacation. That you've been looking for a job for a year and your boyfriend didn't work out.
You are out of control.
What?
I've packed your things. They're in the bedroom.
What?
And since you didn't have any money, you decided to move back here.
Is there anything else?
Don't remember anything.
The unprecedented nature of this
phenomenon. You get that tingle? You know you're watching something that's going to change the course of history. You all right?
It's this nervous tick I have.
All right. So that is the trailer for Colossal. A movie that I shall now attempt to describe in a way that doesn't completely...
If you've seen a trailer,
everything. Yeah.
Spoiled things for you.
This is a woman, Anne Hathaway, who is a bit of a mess, a bit of an alcoholic, and her latest rock-bottom moment coincides with the appearance of a monster in Seoul, South Korea. And it turns out that the two may not be as disconnected as they appear. So, let's talk about this film. I'm going to say that the basic... First, we should just say whether or not we think people should see it. And then the basic premise will cease to be a spoiler after that. I think the character turns, we can wait for a spoiler section. But, so just yes or no. Bill Graham, do you think people should see this movie?
Yes.
Okay. Michael Snydell.
No.
All right. I'm going to say yes. So that's two yeses and a no for Colossal. It is out in theaters, some theaters now. Go and find it if you think you're going to agree with me and Bill. Don't go and see it if you think you're going to agree with Michael. Regardless, let's now actually get into what this movie is about proper. So Anne Hathaway... is able
Wait,
to
guys you don't think we should do anything before spoilers?
We're not in spoilers right now.
All right,
that's what he just did.
I literally just had a huge conversation about how I'm just gonna get a yes or no from us before we actually tell you the basic premise of this film.
Fine
don't get snippy with me. I went to very deep degree to explain how this was gonna work to people. We're not in spoilers.
Okay.
But the premise of this film that I tried to obscure a little bit is that Anne Hathaway is able to manifest and control this monster so long as she is in a particular place at a particular time. That being 8.05 a.m. and a school playground. And so the things that begin to happen spiral outward from her discovery of that. So let's talk about it. Let's see what we thought of Colossal. Bill Graham, let's start with you.
I have to say I was pleasantly surprised by how many kind of turns this film has, even despite watching the trailers multiple times. I've seen quite a few trailers for this. And they did a good job of selling the premise, selling kind of the setup, but not necessarily the execution and the way that it was going to kind of twist and turn. So it's got a nice kind of meaty hook. Like we were mentioning, you know, the film starts off with this idea that she's a drunkard. She's suddenly has this situation crop up where she kind of discovers that there's a link between her and the monster. And it goes into both pleasant and unexpected ways, but also kind of troubling ways. I think for me, this film is kind of capped off by the finale, and it's unfortunate that you know, I can't discuss that right now in the non-spoiler section. But I think some of my issues with the film, where it goes and how it handles certain situations, are kind of glossed over by the end, and I could kind of appreciate it a little bit more. It definitely has a much darker tone that it turns into towards the last half of the film that I really was not expecting. This film at first seems like a very kind of happy-go-lucky film. And one thing that I really appreciated about it is that the destruction here is – like actually affects the characters in a very human and real way. And I really appreciated that. And what else? I think Dan Stevens is both. He's got a standout scene in a hotel room, that is, pretty comical. I don't know how they wrangled him into playing this boyfriend character. It seems like such a small role, but he does really kind of nail it in that hotel scene. And I was pleasantly surprised by Jason Sudeikis. I think he's turning in really good work here as Anne Hathaway basically moves back home, and she bumps into a old elementary school friend who is like, "Hey, you're kind of down on the ropes. You know, I'll help you out. I'll be a friend for you." She, as Brian was mentioning, she is a drunkard, and it just happens that he owns a bar. And so you can kind of see where that is going to go and kind of head. It's a fun dynamic that they kind of play out in a way that is both kind of sweet and kind of sour at the same time. I think if you've seen some of Nacho Vigalondo's previous films, Time Crimes for me still is a standout from him. I still don't think he's ever quite topped that. But it's definitely – this is definitely another film that is wholly original in my kind of view and estimation of where it goes and how it treats the circumstances. And it's got his kind of twist. But I think it's got some troubling gender issues. But beyond that, I think it is a fairly entertaining film. So I would definitely recommend it.
All right. Michael Snydell, what about yourself?
I think this movie has a few good ideas, and you know, for the first half, I thought it was fine. I honestly found it pretty tedious and repetitive pretty early on. And then I think it switches, and at least a few of these characters have no resemblance to the characters of the first half. And it bothered me to a point where I was just completely taken out of the movie. Beyond that, I just I haven't seen any of Vigilando's other films. From the beginning, the rhythms of this just felt off to me, and it just bothered me how this is a hangout movie, but I always felt like it should have more urgency, and when things did happen, they felt entirely unmotivated to me. The lion's share of my issues are things that can't be discussed right now, but I never really thought this movie was ever as clever or as funny as it wanted me to think it was, especially in relation to Anne Hathaway's character, who I think really kind of gets short shrift by the end, is just kind of pushed out of the way for stories that feel inevitable but not satisfying to me in any way. Again, I'm speaking very vaguely because everything I guess I want to talk about is in spoilers. But, you know, there are – I think Vigilando's a good filmmaker. There's a lot of, like, random, really interesting compositions. One I can speak to that's not in spoilers is I shouldn't even say that. Sorry, that has other implications. There's moments in this movie, but I honestly don't ever think it goes far enough. And once it actually does want to switch, it feels like an entirely different movie to me. But yeah, well, I'm looking forward to talking about it more.
I quite enjoyed this movie. I thought it was funny. I thought that the actors were all uniformly great in it. Anne Hathaway in particular, and Jason Sudeikis, who has always been playing this kind of guy, but I feel like this is the first time that the like inherent darkness in the soul of all of his previous characters is really like brought to the fore. And I think that Vigilando is just a really great director in terms of using visual cues in place of other things. There's a repetition here where you know what time it is by the fact that a bunch of children are walking to a bus stop, and
those kids are really timely, by the way.
Well, it's funny because, like, you know, when you're that age, like, it's not you, it's your parents. You know, your parents are shuffling you off, and then you meet and you walk, and so, you know, if you're
sure,
if you are trying to figure out what time it is, the kids are walking to the bus stop is probably not to the second workable, but, you know, it's not bad in a pinch. And so that was great. There's a motif with it's that kind of thing that movies do where they'll do a flashback, but they'll like do the first 2 minutes of the flashback,
then
they'll do the last minute of the last flashback plus another minute, and I can never, that's never really something that I enjoy in a movie. But in this case, it was so infrequent that I didn't mind it. I'm still not a fan, but it didn't detract at all. And I found the movie eminently charming. And then when the darker elements start to come up, it became genuinely affecting. And I think that it goes in a lot of interesting places that you wouldn't expect it. Bill, you said there's some troubling gender things. I actually found it interesting how little judgment the movie had for its characters, all but one, probably, and how much Anne Hathaway, you know, in spite of her character's many failings, becomes the only one who has a modicum of self-actualization, and how everyone else if I were to say that this movie had a gender problem, it's just that, like, there's not a single good man in it, but I don't really feel like that's a problem. I mean, like, that's a choice. We're never supposed to feel like one of these guys is a particularly good guy, and so it's not a problem for me that they all come off as schmucks and assholes, respectively.
I will say I like how they reveal. I mean, obviously, at the beginning, that's not a great scene for, you know, Stevens. But as they kind of unpeel the layers and, you know, put her in the middle, I did like how they do that specifically.
Yeah. It's this great thing where, like, at first I was like, okay, so Dan Stevens is he's the square, but the guy who is probably right and she has to get back with. And then as time goes on, you mm-hmm. realize that everyone in this movie is trying to exert a different kind of control. And the one guy who isn't is not, because he's just a milquetoast worthless man. So yeah, it's a very interesting film. It avoids a lot of cliche, and there was I didn't read it. I only read the headline, as goes with most think pieces. But it was something about how Colossal was like insensitive because it used the peril of an Asian city to talk about like white girl problems.
And Jesus.
And I feel like that's definitely a problem that could have been inherent in this movie, but I think that, like Bill, like you said, they do a really fantastic job of not making that the case.
No idea why she gives a shit.
Why who gives a shit?
At Anne Hathaway.
About what?
About anything that happens in this movie in the early going. Like whatever. This is, I guess,
because she's a fucking human.
No. You don't know why she cares that she killed 100 people?
No, to contextualize what I'm saying, I guess I have to get into spoilers.
Okay.
Then don't say it.
I am super curious. No, we're going to leave that in as a teaser for the spoilers section because I'm super interested. I guess I'll wrap up so we can get into the spoilers section by saying.
Sure.
This is a movie that might confound some people simply because the explanation for the goings on is like 1980s movie simplistic. But part of
the effects are a little bit, you know, they're meant to be low budget. They're meant to be kind of like, oh, you look at this stuff and you're like, okay, that's, you know, they didn't spend a lot of money on this film, and that's part of its charm.
I would
that's
say
part
it looks
of like
about as good as Pacific Rim.
Ooh.
It's less dark. Okay. That's for sure.
It's very much less dark and grainy than Pacific Rim.
That is true. Okay, fair enough. Fair.
You can actually see what's happening.
Jesus, man. Poor Pacific Rim. Someone forgot to turn on the lights in that fucking movie.
Sorry, Pac Rim.
Okay.
Let's any final thoughts on this before we move on to the spoiler section? Shout out to Tim Blake Nelson.
Yeah, he's great. You know what? These, like you were mentioning, Brian, I think everybody here is turning in really good work. Especially working with Nacho, who has I'll mention this. I've interacted with Nacho before. I've done a couple of interviews with him. This guy is kind of a maniac. And he's super charming, but he is a wild, wild man. He is known for showing up to Fantastic Fest and just having a bunch of antics and things like that. I believe this film also premiered at Fantastic Fest. He's a big fan of Fantastic Fest and it should be mentioned that Neon is actually the distributor that cropped up between Tom Quinn and Tim League, owner founder of Alamo Drafthouse and also Fantastic Fest. So
that reminds me, did you all get the Neon shorts?
Yes.
Before this,
really
Holy
enjoyable
shit.
Mike, are you okay?
All right, I thought that was just my theater. Are you talking about Five Ways to Spend Sunday?
Was like five short stories about technology or something. What did we think? That it's completely unrelated to the movie, so I don't want to spend too much time on it. But what did we think of that?
I enjoyed the hell out of them.
Mike, it sounds like you did not.
No, I thought they were incredibly obnoxious and had nothing to say about the internet.
I don't think, honestly, I don't know what they were trying to say about the internet. I did find they were so short. One of them was like literally 5 seconds long.
Sure.
Yep.
And
yep.
It was a pleasant diversion. And I think it was just so unexpected and so interesting that I like kind of found myself wishing that more films would do that. You know, as long as they're not, you know, Lost City of Z length.
Guys, I've seen college shorts that felt more complete than
like,
those.
That's kind of what I'm talking about. Like, how cool would it be to like see one of those college shorts like randomly before a movie? Like,
wait, I don't want to see them ever again. No, I've already seen them.
Well,
in
you
college,
wouldn't have to be those, Michael. I feel like you're inherently not getting the premise I'm putting out. Like, wouldn't it just be fun every now and then for before a movie for like a 2 to 3 minute diversionary short film that is shorter than the Coca-Cola commercial that happens before most movies?
Sure.
Just as like a lark, just a thing that happens. You know, obviously you'd have to match them tonally, but like, you know, Pixar and Disney are doing this and that's cool.
Mm-hmm.
But I think it would be interesting to like just put a little short in front of a movie every now and then.
A lot of festivals do it too, so.
Yeah, I enjoy it. I enjoy it.
Yeah.
Yep.
All right. So now that we've talked about that, let's get into spoilers. Michael Snydell, you had an inflammatory statement that I still haven't been able to suss out in my mind. So why don't you explain? Do
sure.
you think she shouldn't care about the destruction
no.
she's causing?
No, that's not what I'm saying. Although I certainly sound like someone pissed in my cornflakes today.
Yeah, I'm just curious because I was talking about like the weight that her actions have on her. And you said,
sure.
I don't know why she cares, as though destroying a neighborhood of Korea doesn't really bother you that much. So what were you talking about?
Fuck Korea. No. Okay.
Which one?
Yeah.
All right. So anyway, I guess what I mean by that provocative statement is that, you know, when that first enters into the movie, she's just like her immediate reaction is to freak out about it. And, you know, she finds out I did like it was a nice touch. You mentioned time already, Brian, but like it's 11 hours after it happened. Like
yeah.
I did like that touch. But I didn't ever feel it was organic that she reacted in the way she did, even beyond its like evocation of like liberal guilt or this, you know, this character that she this construct
saying,
of someone.
Just to clarify, you mean
sure.
before she even knows she is the monster, you weren't sure why she was reacting to the sight of a giant monster destroying a city so strongly?
It felt off to me in the way that it was presented. And I guess I can't quite put my finger on exactly what it was, but from that moment, I was immediately feeling a mechanical aspect to this script, even before it actually gets going. And so, like, for that to be an impetus for a lot of things to emerge from, including, you know, a lot of, like, concrete plot things in terms of her realizing, you know, her kinship with the monster and, you know, and everything down the road, that early thing was just not something that drew me in the same way that I found an authenticity to people flocking to the bar to watch this monster. Like there was something about that moment that felt more true to me than her freaking out about her computer. And maybe that's just because when we first meet her, you know, in that introduction scene, you know, she is being thrown out of her apartment by Dan Stevens' character because her alcoholism has kind of, you know, reached a new low. And but like that point where we're supposed to immediately understand why she's feeling that way, I didn't understand why that character reacted in that way beyond like a See, like, that's the thing, because I feel like this is partly trying to get out of like a performance. Wait, wait.
Okay. I have no idea what to do with this. Sorry.
I feel like this movie wants to say something about performative empathy and like self-absorption, but at no point do I feel like it has any interest in those ideas beyond using it as a way to get into this monster movie.
I don't.
And so, like,
I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Go ahead, Brent.
I don't feel like the movie is trying to be about performative empathy at all.
No, it's
explain,
not.
Explain that. Explain that a little bit.
I don't think Anne Hathaway's character really. I didn't understand her. I didn't find her convincing, like, from that beginning. Like, so the whole movie just felt like I kept wondering, like, okay, is she going through the motions? Is she, you know, before she finds out that, you know, she can control this monster. Guys, it's not like a logical through line here I have. It's like a fundamental disconnect with the rhythm.
Yeah.
That's what it is. And I'm reacting specifically to the fact that this movie feels very constructed to me. And at no point did I find her character to be organic in her reactions. And that's even before she does things that just baffle me.
I don't find any of her actions really all that baffling, to be honest with you.
Weirdly, I agree with Bill.
I found Sudeikis, some of his actions, to be a little bit baffling, but
he's a different character in the second half. But
sure, part of that is just like, look, it's a movie villain. Like not every movie villain has to have these like drawn out conclusions and reasons why. I think what they kind of dig out of his character when she visits his house, you're just like, holy shit, this guy is a mess. Like, his bar seems to be in pretty good working order, but you go to his house and you know you hear this story about how a couple of years before that he asked a woman to move in with him, and you can imagine him having her move into that place. Either that's the way it's turned out to become after she kind of left him, or it was the way it was when she moved in, and that's probably part of the reason why she moved out.
Yeah. My thing about just to piggyback off the Jason Sudeikis comment, I mean, he's the same character. It's just so okay, we haven't even mentioned the fact that he also has a colossal manifestation,
yes,
in Soul.
So
Anne Hathaway, I'm gonna do a brief rundown that I hope will also help me to come back against a little bit of what Mike said. Anne Hathaway is, I would say, reasonably terrified that halfway across the world, a giant monster destroyed part of Seoul, South Korea.
And then fucking disappeared.
Right, and then disappeared. And at this point, the concept is, okay, there's a giant monster, and it could possibly appear anywhere without any notice. And then she discovers that she is the monster, quite on accident. It's actually a funny scene. The monster, she's having an argument with her ex-boyfriend Tim, Dan Stevens.
Yes.
And
yes.
So the monster is
as she's walking through a park, right?
Yeah. The monster is on the phone, but like isn't holding a phone. So basically, imagine a giant monster pantomiming a human phone conversation and then throwing the phone, but of course it's a pantomime, so it doesn't have anything. And then she's like, oh my god, I can control this thing. So she does a test, and it works. And then she quite drunkenly, as drunk people are going to do, brings a bunch of friends over and is like, holy shit, watch this, guys. And she falls over when Jason Sudeikis tries to get her out. And it turns out that he is a giant manifested robot. And so during this drunken, stupid thing she did, and it feels like she's the type of person who does a lot of drunken, stupid things all the time, she kills quite a lot of people, and she feels legitimately bad about it. She never wants to do this again. She is horrified But the world
and
is
she
also,
sobers up.
Yeah. And then she writes a missive to the people of Korea and the world in the dirt as the monster. And so the world unites and everyone's really happy, and the monster is really, like, you know, kind of becomes a folk hero, sort of, because she made the monster write, like, I'm so sorry, it won't happen again, it was an accident. Uh-huh. And that's kind of like a catharsis for her, because usually when she would do that, no one would accept the apology because they know her pattern. But the people of Korea and the world accept it from the monster, and so she's like, well, if the monster can be forgiven, maybe I can become better than I am. But the problem is that Oscar, played by Jason Sudeikis, is classic... I hate the term nice
shithead.
Guy. Yeah. But he's a nice guy shithead. He begins the movie trying to be super cool and nice and accommodating.
Just shows up with, like, new things for her house.
Yeah. Like I said, he's like classic quote unquote nice guy. And she, for whatever reason, falls for her milquetoast, or his milquetoast best friend, Joel.
I'll mention one thing real quick. If you recognize that character, his name is Austin Stoll. He is the backup drummer in Whiplash. He's the redheaded asshole backup drummer.
Oh, nice.
So that's why you recognize him.
I was legitimately wondering about that. Because, yeah, I did sort of recognize him. But so then Jason Sudeikis, who, again, has never made a move on her, has never expressed any interest in her, is just giving her a job and alcohol and stuff. And then he flips. He becomes, you know, he starts using his giant robot to basically hold Seoul, South Korea hostage so that she'll have to stay. Not even be with him, just stay around.
Yeah.
And I think that, you know, he seems like a whole different character, but you can see the human scale representation of that early in the movie. And then it's just, he's an asshole who suddenly got a tremendous amount of power and is willing to use it because he's a piece of shit. He's a real shithead, as Mike said.
But he's a cartoon.
Yeah.
He's no longer a real person in the second half of that movie. And I ceased caring and found even emotional moments deeply stupid.
But I mean, like when they're fighting real people. I mean, that first scene is like literal Looney Tunes.
Yeah. Yeah. Having all her friends like come over as soon as Tim leaves the apartment. Like,
and Tim just
and that
like,
whole sequence.
Your stuff's in the bedroom and I'm going to go and I don't think you should be here. Okay. Bye. Like,
I mean, I recognized her as like a believable vessel of self-destruction, like in that first scene, even as that thing is obviously played as a joke, you know, of her having friends come up immediately. Like her cynicism and narcissism is like, or sorry, not cynicism, her narcissism is very recognizable there. But she becomes less recognizable as a character to me. And then the movie becomes even less interested in her as a character because they just want to create this dynamic where she has in the middle of two people who bully her in, you know, two ways. Like,
I'm
you,
there
you
to
obviously
see a problem.
Had issues with this.
There's
with
a
this,
point where this movie just went off the cliff and I couldn't come back.
Okay.
From it.
I mean, I guess that's understandable, especially if you're, I mean, like, at no point was this movie like Manchester by the Sea, like, for me. It was never a realistic depiction of anything. And I'll tell you how I know that. Because no real alcoholic ever just gets trashed on beer. And this is something
that
happens. Yeah, this is something that happens in so many movies. What's that movie where, like, Reese Witherspoon is in a coma and Mark Ruffalo has to save her?
What? I have no idea.
It's like
Heaven Help Us, or not Heaven Help Us. What is
it's
it?
It's like Far From Heaven or Heaven Can Wait or someone look this up while I talk. He is portrayed in that
just
movie.
Just like Heaven.
Just like Heaven. He is portrayed in that movie as like a helpless alcoholic, and all he ever does is buy like six packs of beer. And And that's just that is something that like it's the same
You would quickly get used to drinking six beers a night. Like yeah, like your tolerance level would quickly get to a point where you're just like, okay, this doesn't work anymore.
Yeah, like, it's like the Simpsons. Like you can have a lovable quote unquote alcoholic as long as they only ever drink beer. But the second that you see Jason Sudeikis in this just swigging out of a bottle of Jack Daniels, you're like, he's the bad kind of alcoholic.
Yeah.
Because a person who drinks too much beer just likes to party too much. But a person who drinks Jack straight out the bottle, he's a maniac and he should be stopped.
Yes.
And I say this as a person who used to drink Jack straight out of the bottle.
But I find that switch so... so dramatic that I can't reconcile that these are two parts of the same movie. I recognize what you're saying, that there is still like a heightened aspect to our alcoholism and a, you know, an inauthenticity.
No one has ever wanted a PBR as much as she wanted that PBR.
But the way, then why not make, you know, the movie in the second half, you know, the Alex de Iglesia. Like, why not make that movie? Because these...
Okay, I wasn't sure if you were done asking your question or you were going to keep talking. So the point of this movie isn't so much like, oh, she's a wreck and she has to, like, get control of herself. It's she has to stop, like, ceding control.
But it
control.
Is, for, like, the
she
first has hour.
To, oh, my God, I'm still talking. She's
Brian,
has to stop,
you interrupt all the fucking time, man.
She has to stop ceding control to these other men in her life. Like she's basically trying to get back under the thumb of Tim, or is pleasantly under the thumb of Oscar. And the movie's kind of about realizing that like everyone around her who wants to quote unquote help her is really just trying to like subjugate her in some way.
Mm-hmm.
And that's
I find
like,
that plot detail. Yeah, I found that plot detail like really fleshed out, and I really enjoyed that aspect of slowly discovering everybody's just kind of either using her for certain things and then not helping her in other ways, like her little boyfriend fling thing. Like he has so many moments, Joel. He has so many moments where he could like stand up and like support her, and he fucking does nothing.
Yes.
Nothing. And you're just like, what are you? Like, why are you such a spineless human? Like, you would sleep with her, but you're not gonna like and he's the one that initiates it originally.
Yeah.
Right? And you can tell there's some background there between him and Jason Sudeikis' character, but you don't quite understand like where he's coming from. He's at a completely different fucking bar by the end of the movie. He's in like New York or something.
Well, he can't go to Jason Sudeikis' bar because they got some bad blood now.
It's okay. They have new management.
Yeah, but. Yeah, that whole situation was really, really crazy to me. Like to see him, and even Tim Blake Nelson's character. Like, sure. They just, I guess they have a friendship, a camaraderie with Jason Sudeikis, and they just get to a point where that's comfortable, and they don't want to push beyond that. And as soon as Sudeikis pushes beyond that, they just don't know how to react anymore. They're just like, well,
have you
shit,
ever had
this
that
was
kind of friendship like where you've known each other long enough. And it's like, well, it's like the classic train spotting friendship where it's like, well, he's a psychopath, but he's a friend. It's like, well, why is he your friend? I don't know, but he is. And now that word has been put out there, I really can't turn my back on him.
Yep.
But that's the weird thing, because like, you know, I found those characters really interesting, like especially the scene that Bill was kind of alluding to where Joel like comes to her house the day after he comes to her house in the morning and he's like, oh, he's doing fine now, everything's cool, like,
yeah,
you know, right after he just did something horrifying the night before. And you know that Tim Blake Nelson character is like interesting, and but that, But like, and then even Jason Sudeikis' character, I found his like quiet seething very interesting, and like how he keeps bringing things over. Like those things are all very recognizable. So that's the thing. When it then is pitched up two octaves, like I'm like, why?
Because there's a monster involved.
I know, but that doesn't make it okay. And the monster is just, I think it looks kind of stupid. And I honestly didn't have any, I know that I'm supposed to care what's happening in Korea, but I wasn't feeling the juxtaposition to be organic in any way. Brian, I'm not saying I don't have empathy here. I'm saying that
I'm just
the way that
the
film presents it.
The angry tweets already, but I fully understand what you mean.
I'm saying that
you didn't connect with this level on a or with this movie on a multitude of levels, and I mean you've already said that you did not like the way that Anne Hathaway's character was kind of being portrayed from the outset, and if our through line throughout this entire film is her emotional journey, and you're like, nope, not on board. You missed that fucking train and you just sat down for a 2-hour movie. Like, sorry.
I mean, I think the real headline here is Michael Snydell doesn't care about Korea. That's definitely what I'm going to put in the tweet.
Specifically South
though.
Korea.
I find it weird.
He loves North Korea.
That this plot is, you know, doing some bold things, both things I don't particularly like, but I feel like the plot is always doing interesting things, but the characters are just totally erratic just throughout, and not in risky or interesting ways, in ways that just makes this conflict more and more black and white. And
but I mean is there okay, I'm having trouble putting this into words. I mean, Oscar, played by Jason Sudeikis, is very clearly an abusive man who is willing to use threats of violence and actual violence to get his way. Like, is there any way to not make that black and white?
Yeah, I mean, I guess the shift is that, you know, if you're going to pick the exact moment it switches, it's after he finds out that Joel had a white knight stand with
it's
Gloria.
Intimated.
Yeah.
Is that where you guys would put the switch?
I mean,
if you were going to pinpoint it.
Yeah, that's definitely where the hard switch comes. I think that him just going back there and being the robot after they had already fixed things with the monster, that lets you know what kind of a man he is. Also the fact that that he flipped out the first time when Joel just tried to kiss Gloria. And he is like, oh, you just got to go and ruin everything, man. And I was like, whoa, unnecessary anger. And I thought that at that point it was weird for the character because it didn't seem like the type of thing he'd do. And then at the end of the movie, I grew to understand, like, that's on purpose.
Yep.
Like,
I mean, to be clear,
off.
I think he's an asshole from minute one.
Yeah.
But
that is 100%. This is so weird because if there were a moment in this movie that I think were to have gone too far, it's the time when he sets off the firework in his bar.
Yep. Oh my God, yes.
But I loved that scene.
It's a lot of fun.
Yeah, Jason Sudeikis like sinks his teeth into that weird little monologue. I think his whole being, where like he's still being nice to the patrons, even as he's like,
I love that,
setting this
rolling
up,
the table.
Yeah, he throws the chairs and throws a table, and like these two people run out and he's like, oh, hey, have a great day. Come again soon. And then he goes back to like, and it's not even menacing. I don't know. It's Jason Sudeikis is an interesting actor in that way because you have him in something like Horrible Bosses where he's just a heel and he's good at it. And then in this movie, he comes off as like your stereotypical like good time Charlie, but then flips around and becomes like a terrible human being. But you can still see like in a moment like that, that just because he's a bad person doesn't mean he's not entertaining in the way that would make people want to initially hang out with him.
Sure.
And then just, I like fireworks inside. I don't know.
It was a lot of fun. I enjoyed that scene. Okay, I thought I was going to sneeze. I enjoyed that scene particularly because of like what Brian was saying is Sudeikis's delivery, especially during – like it echoes the delivery that he gives earlier in the film when he's being a hard ass to Gloria and the rest of them about like putting up the screen, the projector screen. And, you know, there's like a certain level of like just menace to his tone that you can't quite understand. And that entire sequence is kind of played out again when he's asking Gloria to do certain things at the bar while Tim is sitting across from him. And then, you know, you think maybe that his monologue is about her bringing Tim into the bar.
Sure.
Right. I think that's where it's kind of leading you down astray a little bit. And then it's like, no, here's this giant fucking firework that you're just like, what is that thing? And then you're just like, oh, shit, he's about to light this thing. And so, like, this is really irresponsible.
And he's not wrong. That is the most irresponsible thing he could do in that bar.
So I really enjoyed that whole setup and execution. I do want to mention before we go too far away, that, you know, other quietly comical, like darkly comical moments are, it's gotta be like one of my favorite sequences. The standouts is there are apartment complexes around the park. And at a certain point, everybody starts to realize that at 8:05 a.m., whatever time zone you are, people are starting to tune into this live stream that focuses in on Seoul, South Korea at a certain point. And so everybody else around the U.S., around the world is probably like tuned in around that time just to see what the hell is going to happen. And when they start fighting – Jason Sudeikis and Gloria, when they start fighting,
she slaps him, and then points, and everyone cheers.
Everyone in the background, like you don't see them, but you hear quiet cheers in the background, and it's just little things like that that pepper this film that just bring it so much character. I can tell it's Nacho's like he's the writer and director of this film, and I can tell that is his like darkly comical humor,
right? Because a lesser movie bill I think in this would have like that cutaway to like a bunch of bros like watching and cheering, and I think it's a lot more effective just to be able to hear it. Because it keeps the world insular, but lets you know that they're still affecting the world outside of them.
There's a few compositions I like in that same respect. One is really early on where she's in front of the TV and in the middle, so the buildings frame both sides of her in a really sly way. And then right at the end, the way that sound design works, where she's on the ground and he's stomping right next to her. There's a... And then there's screams, or screams as well, presumably, you know.
It's the audio from what's in Seoul happening around her. There's
definitely those things, but like, I wanted more of that. I wanted more of just like people talking or you know, speculating about what the monster is. Like you have that early scene where Tim Blake Nelson and. I guess probably it's Jason Sudeikis' character talking about how it seems very mechanical, like it's controlled by a robot. There are little details that tell me there's something else going on beyond, like, you know, the school kids walking past or cheers in the distance, you know, those things. But a lot of times I did feel like this world felt so insulated and that it wasn't affecting other people except in those – you know, single scenes. Like it's just it's a weird thing where, because you see parts of that, you don't notice it, you notice it when it's not there. So it's in that weird thing where it's just not quite enough for me, but I'm aware it's there.
I thought it was enough to let you know it's happening without bogging down the narrative that the movie is actually trying to tell.
Yeah.
Like, you know, they go to the gas station and there's a sign that says, like, you know, help for soul. And it's obvious that it's like when everyone had like a sign up that was like, give money to help Haiti.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I thought there was just enough of that without, because it's a small town. They all seem to know each other. It, you know, it didn't. Mm-hmm. It, if this was still taking place in Manhattan, oh god, it would be a shit show, I'm sure. But yeah, I was.
Well, the other motif I really enjoyed is the outset of kind of Gloria's introduction to the city, and she's lugging around this square object in a bag that you just can't quite understand what the hell it is, and it even has the silhouette of her dragging it when she's a monster at one point, which was hilarious. But then you find out it's the most simple thing that most people want. The first thing when they move into a new place is it's an air mattress, and it's like, okay, like that's what she's been lugging around. I just love, there's so many little tiny details of just like, why would they keep that a secret? But it's fun because the entire time you're seeing this thing she's dragging around, and she drags around for a good like day and a half. Yeah. Because she spends all day at the bar, and then she comes back like later that night. Or later that morning, it's 8:05 p.m.
This
or
girl
a.m.
cannot sleep in a bed to save her life.
it's pretty comical. Yeah. Yeah. The other kind of gender thing that I enjoyed, that, you know, as a guy, I never quite like realized, was when she falls asleep and that air mattress has flattened out for whatever reason. Either it's got a hole or she, you know, hit it with her hand, the little release button or whatever. When she wakes up, she's rubbing her chest, and I was like, oh shit, it would probably really hurt if you fell asleep on your chest and you were a woman. Like, that mm-hmm. that makes yeah. sense. And that was a character detail that, like, I'm not sure if that was Nacho's idea, but it may have been something that Anne Hathaway was like, hey, if I fell asleep for 8 hours on my chest, I would wake up and they would be sore. Like,
especially, it appears that she's still wearing a bra.
Yeah. And so, yeah, she fell asleep in her fucking clothes. Like, yeah, she's definitely wearing a bra. So, yeah, like, I can imagine, like, there's just so many little details like that pepper this film that I really, really enjoy, that just feel like a wholly original kind of creation. You know, those are the kind of things that I really enjoy. My one big issue, go ahead, Michael.
Oh, I just wanted to briefly piggyback on, I really like Anne Hathaway's sense of posture and body language in this. Like, there's an exasperation to the way she kind of almost like trudges to every new place, or I should say trudging or running. And it's constantly a reflection of her mental state. And, you know, even if it's just her being hungover or, you know, being panicked about what Jason Sudeikis' character is going to do next, like, there's a really palpable range of emotion to how she moves in this movie.
I will mention one thing that I kind of noticed in the background is that, like, she seems like the kind of person that outside of work, she just lets it kind of all hang out. Because, like, outside of work, you're right, she's got like this posturing, and like the way she moves about things is just like, ugh, like, I gotta go do this. But if you notice in the background, when she's like being a waitress, she seems to have it all kind of together, and yeah. she's upright, and her posture changes when she's at work. Right. And, you know, you don't see her ever like spill a drink or do anything that's like klutzy or, you know, anything like that. And she never looks like she's out of it at work. It looks like she's fully like, you know, toned or tuned in and everything like that. So it seems like she's one of, and, you know, I've met people like that. I've had days like that where I'm just like, ugh. And then I get to work and I'm like on. Right.
Yeah.
Because, sure. you know,
and that lets you know
it's,
that, like,
it's your living.
It's yeah, and it lets you know that, like, this whole her being out of work for a year thing isn't like an excuse. Like, I'm sure that when she was writing, like, she was on ball.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So it gives you an idea, you know, she's not like the Casey Affleck character from Manchester by the Sea, who's constantly broken. Like, her losing her job may have actually had something to do with this.
And she is genuinely motivated when she gets that job at the bar, as much as Dan Stevens' character, you know, wants to dismiss it immediately, thinking it's just an excuse.
Yeah.
What a dick all the guys in this are, except for Joel, who, like, stumbles into everything and it's just a milquetoast.
Yeah.
My
one criticism really is such a Bill criticism, because, you know, it's one of those things. No, it's one of those things. If it actually happened, we wouldn't have much of a movie. But I found Sewell's reaction to having a giant monster that appears at 8:05 p.m. On a normal, regularly scheduled basis. I found like, when we finally see what they're doing, like, when Anne Hathaway finally visits that location, they all seem to be just kind of, like, hanging out and then, like, holy shit, there's that monster again. Like, wait a second.
It's like, how does anyone get stuck outside during the Purge? Like, you should be ready for this. Like, why? It was kind of weird that there were still so many people around.
I found that. Yeah, it's one of those things that bugs me, but it's like, I know we wouldn't have much of a movie if that was real, but I feel like we would still kind of have a sense of destruction.
It seems like they had a perimeter, and then that people were just trying to get further away from the perimeter.
Sure.
Because when she actually goes to the place where the robot is, she is fairly alone.
Sure.
Yeah.
But
I don't know why they wouldn't do coverage in bunkers or something. Like, I mean, obviously budget constrictions.
Also, it's only been like 5 days, so they haven't had time to get a contractor and drop the plans and then pour the concrete for the bunkers.
I thought it's been like a couple of weeks. I don't know. Maybe
is this a Ross scenario where we all think it's a different amount of time?
Can we get a spouse approval at some point? Can we get an outside source? Can we call a friend?
Unfortunately, I saw this movie alone, so I don't know who else I would call.
Damn it.
We've talked about this a lot. Any final thoughts before we wrap up for today?
Should we talk about the flashback or the ending?
I already said kind of thematically what I thought the ending was, but like, yeah, I mean, we can, you know, she goes to Seoul and that projects her monster by the playground, which was pretty cool.
Yeah, I found that immensely satisfying when it's one of those rare moments where you're like, you kind of figure out the end before before it reveals itself, right? They do enough to kind of where I love the map, because the map shows like her through line, her kind of clear distinction of like, hey, here's what's happening over here, and this is what's happening, you know, at the exact same time. And it's like, wait. And so towards the end of the movie, you're kind of thinking like, what happens if like they flip? And so I really enjoyed that kind of setup and execution. It's one of those rare moments, like I said, where it just feels immensely satisfying to see it kind of fully realized and then happen.
Also, like, good on her for being able to grab him.
Yeah. Like, yeah. I was wondering how she was going to do that. And I was just like, how is this dynamic going to, is she just going to stomp on him? Like try and like stomp on a giant monster. I thought she was literally going to
so cool.
I thought she was literally going to
in a place. And then all of a sudden you see that giant robot just like get crushed.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I thought it would have been hilarious if she would have had to get so, like, you know, the dynamics of like her being monster size are a little bit different, but I thought it would have been hilarious if they had her like literally walk out to an area where the monster is, or where the robot is standing, and she's got to like stomp on on like his leg, and all of a sudden like she crushes it, and you're just like, what? Like I thought that view would have been hilarious and like perfect for this film. Didn't quite go that way, but yeah, I was still satisfied immensely by that kind of twist ending.
Is the only significance of the playground just that map scene?
What do you mean?
The significance of the geography of the playground being like the exact point. Yeah.
Yeah, it seems like, you know, they just happened to build a playground around where lightning struck her.
Sure.
P.S. This is a lightning strike movie. My favorite kind of movie. How does this person become this incredible thing? I don't know, lightning. All right.
Cool. Yeah.
I appreciate the cliched nature of the lightning strike most times more than, like, it's ambiguous and we're never going to explain it.
By the way, how does she not remember immediately that this is the dickhead who stomped on her project in front of her?
I think that she remembered him, like, going to get the project, but that it took a bit for her to remember, oh wait, he fucking destroyed it.
Yeah.
Like, I think she's
got a Bill memory problem.
Also, she was struck by lightning. I mean,
yeah,
I think there's something to you.
Yeah, there's a lot at play there.
I just didn't ever get a sense that when it came to I think about whether a character is convincing, I didn't get a sense when things happen in this movie that it ever felt like anything except a script moving it forward. Like I never felt like there was organic character action that felt motivated. Like that moment, especially I'm thinking of where she just realizes that. Like, it's just, this movie just meanders for so long and it goes in circles and is repetitive, and then they raise the stakes randomly. Like, it's just, the rhythms of this thing are so bizarre in the sense of, and I guess a lot of people are finding this admirable that it sometimes feels like a mumblecore, or, you know, a Swanberg movie at times.
This
but
is
like,
so far from mumblecore. Like,
you're telling me that the conversations in the bar didn't remind you of Drinking Buddies?
No. Because the mumblecore, like, this is a very firmly written movie. Like, there is a rhythm to the dialogue, and mumblecore.
Okay, but there is a
very
shagginess to the conversations.
But it's a very definite stylized shagginess. Mumblecore is just, I don't know, you guys hang out over there, and I'll just cut around the boring parts. And it literally is just people mumbling at each other. And sometimes it's good, like in Hump Day and the Puffy Chair, and sometimes it sucks, like Drinking Buddies.
I didn't find any of those issues. Yeah. And Michael, like, it's been very clear to this point, like, you really did not enjoy this movie.
I'm just going to say,
on multiple levels.
Just because a bunch of middle class white people are drinking and talking doesn't make a movie mumblecore.
That's not what I said, Brian.
I'm just saying.
Don't change what I said. That's not what I said.
So I'm fine with the lightning strike. I think that the ending is very, it's good. I liked her whole, like, you know, I'm way more out of control now line.
And throwing him into the sun.
Just tossing him. That was fun. And then,
It's fun. Okay.
Yeah, I don't care what happens. Like, he was a dick. Yeah, I mean, you know, he's like, let me down. And then he like calls her a bitch. And like, it's kind of funny because like, he should know that she can't hear him. But he's still an asshole. He's still just an asshole. And then I like her going to a bar. She's about to tell this woman this story, and the woman says, okay, do you want a drink? And she like sighs because she remembers that's still something she's got to work through because she got sidetracked by this whole monster thing.
Yep.
Yeah, I thought that was clever.
Good movie,
guys. I enjoyed it quite a bit. Michael Snydell did not. That is a prerogative. It is out in theaters now. I was actually surprised that this was at a multiplex near me. Because
why?
Just because given the lack of marketing for it, I just assumed I was going to have to go to an indie theater. So if you're listening to this and thinking, man, it sucks that I live in a place that doesn't have an independent theater, look it up anyway, because it may be at your local Regal or AMC or Cinemark. I don't know.
Yeah. I guess I should say, that I'm definitely in the minority on this one. Like, not only on this podcast, but in general, there's a lot of people who adore this movie. So if you want to give it a shot, go for it.
Yes. And if you either agree with Michael or want to toss even more shit on him, email us podcast@thefilmstage.com and let us know what you think, or find us on Twitter @FilmStageShow. Bill, you seemed like you were about to say something.
It was interesting because you were mentioning how I guess you didn't get advertised to it a lot. But I realized as soon as I was about to speak up, I was like, oh, yeah, Brian does not go to the Alamo Draft House. And B, I remembered that this is Neon and this is Tim League and this is Alamo Draft House, and I was like, oh, because I've gotten so many previews for this film the last like 2 months,
you go to the Alamo Draft House.
Yeah. And so naturally they're gonna advertise their own in-house kind of distribution stuff, so
yeah, it's like the commercials for the X-Men movie on like Fox or FX. Like, that's just,
if you somehow have not seen a trailer, don't watch it. I definitely think I think that some things were ruined for me.
You're saying this at the end of the spoiler section.
Yeah, I know.
I had the opposite reaction. I was pleasantly surprised by the things that were not revealed. Like, it's enough of a hook that you're like, oh, I'm gonna see where goes.
I had only seen the poster for this movie, and I thought I was going to hate it just because of that poster. But I didn't. I quite enjoyed it. So how about that? So that's all for today. We are once again brought to you by Mubi, MUBI.com, the streaming online cinema, where every day their curators give you a brand new movie to watch. You have 30 days to watch, and then it disappears. So that's 30 movies rotating constantly. And you have the ability to download these movies onto your mobile devices, such as your iPhone, iPad, etc. For your free 30-day trial of Mubi, all you have to do is go to MUBI.com/filmstage, and you will get 30 days on us to try out what I believe is one of the best streaming services out there in terms of both quality of film content and UI. All right, that is all for today. The next time you hear from us, we will be talking about Free Fire, and then hopefully next weekend we'll be able to talk about The Lost City of Zed, or Z, or whatever. In the meantime, though, you can find us at the following places. Bill Graham.
Ooh, was not expecting that.
Sorry.
You can find me on Twitter @CableBFG. You can also find me writing about movies at FreshFiction.tv and FilmStage.
All right. Michael Snydell.
Sorry. you can find me on Twitter.
Michael Snydell was caught in the middle of snorting some cocaine.
No, believe me, you don't want me to sneeze on the podcast. It will be terrifying.
Ew, there's mucus all over my podcast.
You could find me on Twitter at Snydell. I occasionally write things. It's been a little while, but I write things that... Film Stage, Case Magazine, and you can find me on Letterboxd and find
all. Alright. You can find me on Twitter @BrianJRowan. You can find me on thefilmstage.com and my personal site, dearfilm.net. I haven't written anything in a while, but I think I'm going to write another personal essay style thing related to my own shitty past. This time related to not Manchester by the Sea, but the newest season of The Leftovers. So keep an eye out for that if you want to get sad. Anyway, join us next time when we'll be talking about Free Fire, and we look forward to hearing from you soon.